So know that help is available. That really helps. And second thing is, just in the privacy of your own mind, dare yourself to imagine what your life would be like if it wasn't controlled by fear and by anxiety and by trauma. Just dare to imagine.
Hello, my name is Wing, and welcome to A Work in Purpose, the podcast for you to discover your purpose by hearing inspiring stories of how people have found their purpose in life, and hear their insights on how you can find yours too. Before I introduce our guest this episode, I want to wish you all a happy new year, and I would like to share the news that this podcast has just reached our 1 year milestone. I'm so grateful that I got to connect and speak with 20 fascinating guests last year, and I want to thank you all for listening. Here to kick us off this year is Dr. Don Russell. Dr. Don Russell is a psychotherapist of 25 years who specializes in trauma and trauma treatment. He's also the author of The Trauma Treatment Companion, a guide to the stabilization of trauma symptoms for smooth recovery from trauma of all kinds. If you have experienced trauma in the past and you are trying to resolve it so you can finally live a full life, or if you know someone close who has experienced trauma and you want to know how to best support them, then stay tuned. In this episode, you'll hear practical tips on how to resolve trauma, how to replace debilitating thought patterns and emotions with new ones that serve you better, how to get out of your comfort zone, and so much more incredible insights. So without further ado, here's Dr. Don Russell. Hello, and welcome to A Work in Purpose podcast. I'm very excited to have you on, Dr. Don Russell. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really great, Wing. Thanks so much for this opportunity. I love it.
Great. So I would like to ask first, can you share a bit more about what is it that you do that you find is work that fulfills your purpose?
Yeah, sure thing. So if there's a job description, I'm a counselor, licensed professional counselor is the language used in the US. In Canada, we talk about just counselor or psychotherapist. So I go by psychotherapist. And what I'm doing is working with people, you know, I have a handful of people each day for an hour at a time. And I'm getting into their kitchen. You know, that's a way to describe it. I'm getting into conversations that people feel like they need to have, but they're maybe afraid to have. Quite likely they've never talked about that stuff with anybody else in their life. And what I'm doing, kind of my mission, or my almost like my vision statement is I'm getting into the personal details of their life because I'm helping them get obstacles out of the way of their life, their heart, their soul, so that they can live their best life. So that's a little bit of my thinking, that people have, people know what kind of a life they want to live, but they're struggling to actually execute it because they've got something in the way. Whether it's, you know, like a bad habit or an addiction or junk from their past, maybe long ago, but there's something, you know, that's in their heart and soul that's preventing them from living their best life. And so what I'm doing is I'm helping them explore what that is, helping them to identify what that is, and then kind of reaching into the toolbox and grabbing some tools that, you know, have been clinically proven to, you know, get that junk out of the way. And if all goes well, then they can rock their life. They can, you know, actually execute the life that they feel that they have been meant to live.
That's awesome. So your purpose, you would say, is to help people find their full potential and live a happy, joyful life, essentially.
Yeah, that's it. And I mean, that's the sort of the upside, the positive side of the ledger. The other side of the ledger is, well, there's a reason why they aren't. And so we're getting the obstacles out of the way, getting the baggage out of the way.
So you focus on trauma as your focus, right? Why did you decide to focus on trauma?
Yeah, great question. It was sort of an evolution. I started, you know, the way most people start doing therapy, as a sort of a generalist. you know, kind of whatever comes in the door, I'll try and help with. So, of course, that was, you know, lots of people wrestling with depression, lots of people wrestling with anxiety and, you know, relationship difficulties. And so that's where I started. And then very slowly, like in a very sort of evolutionary kind of way, I started to, you know, recognize that I'm not actually doing as good a job as I think I should be doing. You know, I'm one of those guys that is, you know, I just always want to do better and be more effective and bring better results. And I was recognizing, you know, there's this pattern of some people that are coming to me that are wanting to help. They really, really want to change, but they're like the conventional tools aren't working. So that got the gears turning. And I started to realize, you know, from not just my own sort of thinking, but, you know, reading and listening to other gurus in the field, that the reason that depression is there, the reason that anxiety is there, is because there's actually trauma underneath. And so if we're going to eliminate the depression, eliminate the anxiety, then we actually have to move the trauma out of the way. So that got me getting some extra training and just sort of resetting that, okay, if we're going to help with the depression, if we're going to help with the anxiety, we need to help with the trauma. So now, yeah, my bread and butter is resolving trauma from, you know, from the recent past, you know, that motor vehicle accident or that sexual assault, but also from, you know, the distant past, you know, with, you know, just difficult childhoods that lots of people have experienced. So that's where I find myself now. And when I describe that to people go, wow, that sounds horrible. That sounds like a horrible way to make a living. But the crazy thing is, I love it. It really resonates with who I am. I just like to think about people and think about, you know, what makes them tick. And so again, that sort of comes back to, I really feel like I'm in my groove. I'm doing what I was meant to do, because it resonates with the person that I am.
Yeah. Wow. That sounds great. So you touch upon some things that happens when we don't deal without trauma. But why can't we just focus on like the present and not analyze the past? Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, let me unpack that. There's I'm gonna take you down a little bit of a rabbit hole.
Okay,
Wayne, if that's okay.
Yeah,
definitely. It you know, in some cases that's what's required. We just need to, you know, be clear with our vision and. You know, the person we want to be, and just make deliberate steps to be that person. Maybe do a little bit of work to sort of align our thoughts, but basically, you know, I want to be a loving person. And so I'm just going to, you know, set my attention on being a loving person. In some cases that works. And, you know, we don't have to go digging into the past at all. Here's the rabbit hole though, that it turns out that our behavior is not only shaped by our thoughts. Like, for example, I want to be a good person, a loving person. But our behavior is actually significantly shaped by our emotions and actually by emotions that are created in the body, because we have this cluster of neurons, which scientists are calling another brain, a cluster of neurons around our heart area. And we have another cluster of neurons around our gut, which researchers are calling another brain. So we have these two other brains besides the one between our ears that are communicating huge amounts of information up to our brain. And dang it all, you know, for guys like me that like to analyze problems, the information coming up from our gut and coming up from our heart is actually ends up controlling our behavior. So I end up saying to myself in my brain, I want to be a good and loving person. And then somebody cuts me off in traffic and like, I want to kill that guy. I'm joking. I'm not going to. But that emotional reaction came out of somewhere else. And that somewhere else is from our body, from our emotions. And that somewhere else is also 9 times out of 10, it's it's a reaction that actually has roots from the past. And that's where trauma treatment comes in, dealing with where that came from and resolving it so that somebody cuts me off in traffic and I go, oh, that person must be having a bad day. I don't need to seek revenge on that person. So sometimes we have to get into the past to clear out the stuff that is from the past, but is actually controlling the present. Mm.
So when you say resolve the trauma, what exactly does that mean? How does someone resolve trauma?
Man, you're asking the $10 questions here. That's great. Resolving the past or resolving old trauma, what we want to accomplish is we want to eliminate the emotional charge out of that past event. The way that we do that, I mean, a variety of different techniques, but at the end of the day, what we're wanting to accomplish is we're wanting to sort of finish. Another word that we could use there is we want to finish the trauma response. Because what happens when we have been traumatized by something is that we have a trauma reaction to the thing that's happening. You know, the car coming at us from, through the intersection that didn't stop at the red light. We have that trauma reaction of, for example, physically bracing against the impact. And then what happens in that event is that the full trauma response gets arrested. It gets stuck midway through the trauma reaction. Because we have this big, massive cortex on top of our limbic region of our brain and our brainstem. And this big, massive cortex starts thinking. And that thinking, believe it or not, actually gets in the way of the more primitive parts of our brain completing the trauma reaction. So let me illustrate, and this will make sense. We know from watching animals that are traumatized, what they do is they have a trauma response, a fight, flight, or freeze response, or maybe a collapse response. And then if they survive that, if, for example, the predator gets scared and runs away, so the injured animal has a chance, it doesn't die. What that injured animal does, or that traumatized animal does, is they slowly come back out of their traumatized state, and you'll see the muscles twitch, and there'll be gross muscle twitching, and the animal will slowly come back to a functioning state, and that animal will not have post-traumatic stress disorder because the trauma sequence has completed, got scared, got traumatized, went into flight, freeze. And then slowly came back out of fight, flight, freeze. So if that happens, then there's no trauma effect. There's no residue. There's just, learning, stay away from the big lions if you're an antelope. But what happens for us human beings with this big, massive cortex in our brain is that interrupts that recovery stage. And what's left is a stored trauma reaction. And then when something that vaguely resembles the original trauma event occurs in our life, maybe decades later, the trauma response replays. Like, oh, I feel like I'm going to die from this thing that's, going to hit me from the left. Or I feel like I can't escape from this sexual assault, even though they're perfectly safe in their current environment. So what people are familiar with is the flashback is actually that replaying of the original trauma experience, because there's this stored trauma energy stuck in the body and the mind, but primarily the body.
Mm. So it sounds like the body and mind are kind of like stuck in fear mode and clouds everything else because of that traumatic experience. Is that
right? Yeah, exactly. The body and the mind are stuck in fear mode. And since fear is like everything related to fear is a survival, mechanism, it just takes over. You know, when it gets triggered, it takes over because survival is the most important thing.
Yeah. So how does that relate to reaching our full purpose and reaching our full potential and purpose, having this fear present at all times?
Yeah. Well, I could give a thousand examples. Here's an example. A person, let's keep it non, I don't want to traumatize the audience. So suppose a person in their youth was bullied and made fun of, you know, in grade school. And now they've graduated from grade school. They've got maybe a degree and they're moving up in corporate world and things are doing great. And they're poised to get a promotion, and the promotion will mean that they're going to do some traveling and they have to give presentations in front of, you know, maybe shareholders or maybe clients. But this person has a debilitating fear of public speaking. So if they don't get that fear of public speaking under control, they're actually going to plateau in their career. And they're going to get stuck because if I do public speaking, if I get up in front of an audience, I'll freeze. And all of the fear that I felt back when I was bullied in eighth grade is going to come flooding back. I'll freeze. I won't be able to think. I'll, you know, lose the account or, you know, terrible, terrible things will happen. So that's an example of somebody who's might be held back from reaching their full potential because of an old, you know, an old bullying event from their, you know, from school. And it's haunting them and it's impairing them and it's keeping them from living their best life.
Well, great. Thank you. I want to ask you, from dealing with people who experience trauma, what's your perspective on people who might kind of cling on to their traumatic identity? And because they've been going through life with this identity for so long, they kind of know how to use it to their advantage. And then they cling on to it for those benefits. So like, what would you say to people who are attached to something like that?
Ooh la la. Yeah. You with the great questions again. A couple of different things. First of all, we got to start with empathy. It appears to everybody watching that person that they are, you know, they're playing the victim card and, you know, friends, family sort of want to shake them by the shoulders and say, you know, snap out of it. Don't be such a wuss. Don't play the victim card. But from my work, you know, over the years working with people, what I've learned to understand is that person is scared. That person is controlled by fear. And so, yeah, they are, you know, they are playing the victim card, but they are playing the victim card because they are convinced that they have to live small in order to be safe. So I'm going to start with empathy and just start from there that, yeah, it's scary to imagine living larger. It's scary to imagine living your full potential. It's scary to imagine living without the trump card of I'm a victim of my past. But so, yeah, start with empathy, but yeah, we have to move on. So I'm going to, you know, challenge that person to begin to imagine what it would be like if they did live large, if they did, you know, throw away the victim card and dare themselves to imagine who they could be if they didn't hold themselves back with that. Yeah. Because one thing I know about that person is they're being controlled by fear. The other thing I know about that person is that they are also discontent. They can't actually be enjoying their life right now. There's no way. Because I think we're all meant to, you know, reach for the stars and to do great things. So they can't be enjoying their life right now. And I'm gonna play that card against them, so to speak, and say, yeah, you know, you are meant for more, you know that.
So for people who might be listening and have had sort of these trauma that they're attached to, what would you suggest that they do right now to kind of shift their gear a little bit?
Yeah. Well, first of all, hear loud and clear the message from me, the guy that's been doing trauma treatment for over 25 years, that there is more to life than you are experiencing right now. And there is a way out. So you gotta hear that message that there's more to life than what you're living right now. A while back, I was actually helping a guy, no identifying information here, but he was in his mid-70s. Okay. Mm-hmm. In his mid-70s. And he reached out and said, "Don, I experienced sexual abuse when I was a child." So more than 50 years ago. Okay. And he'd never talked to, I mean, he talked a little bit with his wife, but he'd never sought help until now. He's in his mid 70s. And he said, "Don, I think it's time that I talk about this stuff."
Yeah.
I'm going like, dude, yeah. Yeah. But the point of the story is, yeah, we did. We went to some crazy, terrible places, scary places, and he was maybe the most courageous guy I've ever talked to in all of my work. And at the end of our work together, like I kid you not, at the end of our work together, he was saying, "Hey, Don, you know what, Don? Like, I think I'm good. I don't think I need to talk to you anymore because I'm doing life the way I want to be doing my life. I'm intimate and vulnerable with my wife. I'm not defensive and I'm not argumentative with her. We have a great relationship now. I'm doing it." So for people that are living, you know, with trauma, I want them to hear really clear. First of all, the message that it's possible you can get your life back from trauma. We know way more about trauma and its treatment just in the last 5 years than we've ever known before. And there's really, really good trauma therapists out there and probably in your neighborhood. And if not in your neighborhood, then yeah, you know what? Lots of trauma therapy is happening online. So know that help is available. That really helps. And second thing is just in the privacy of your own mind, dare yourself to imagine what your life would be like if it wasn't controlled by fear and by anxiety and by trauma. Just dare to imagine.
Wow, that's great. Thank you. So once someone has worked on their trauma issues in the past and they've come to like a neutral state, what can they do next to get beyond that neutral, okay, I'm not traumatized anymore, but how can they move from that to living their best life and their full potential?
Ooh la la. Yeah. It's like you've been watching some of my YouTube videos. This is cool. The gurus, the real trauma treatment, believe it or not, it started 150 years ago with Sigmund Freud and guys back there, Joseph Breuer and my hero. So these are guys back in France and Austria, Germany, and Britain. They were actually brilliant. And Pierre Janet, French guy, he sort of introduced this idea that trauma treatment is one stage of trauma treatment. And to your point, after the trauma gets out of the way, the person actually, it's like they take the mask off and they wake up and they discover that they're in this new broad field or pasture with daisies growing in it. And it's like, oh, there's all this potential. Oh my word, I can be whoever I want to be and I can have whatever kind of a relationship I want to have. It's like the fields are broad and the fences are few. So it's about constructing who I want to be and who I want to be in relationship. And That part can be a little bit scary because there's so much freedom there, but it's also just an absolutely fantastic and fun and enjoyable process of, like I say, constructing an identity or discovering a new identity that's not, you know, defined by trauma, defined by anxiety. And so Yeah, it's discovering, it's waking up and kind of looking at oneself and saying, okay, what are the gifts, what are the talents, what are the passions that I have on my inside, and who do they, like, what do these things inform me in terms of who I am as a person and who I want to be in relationship?
Great. What are some of the more effective exercises people can do on their own to figure out the identity they want to create in the future for themselves?
Uh-huh. Oh, wow. Part of it is actually studying relationships around. This past week, I was working with somebody who is letting go of being avoidant of conflict, right? So that was from the old trauma, you know, avoid conflict at all costs. And now they're sort of beginning to think about, oh, you know, maybe I don't have to like give in all the time. Maybe I don't have to avoid conflict at all costs. So the homework that I gave this person was, okay, look around your professional relationships and your personal relationships and just study, how do other people do it? And so just be an anthropologist that just studies people. And in this case, it studies how people do conflict and see how they do it. And just, you know, yep, embrace and integrate the things that you see other people doing that you like. So that's one example. If it was a person that was perhaps in their trauma life, you know, chose a career because, you know, because that was the career that they felt safe in, and now the trauma's out of the way, and they're going to need to look around at other people and see, okay, so what jobs do people actually do? And of course, they know other jobs, they know other vocations, but they need to actually try on in their imagination. So like, why can't I do that? You know, why can't I be a journalist? Or why can't I work in IT? Or why can't I be an upper level manager in this company? Like, because previously I felt disqualified. But maybe now I don't feel disqualified from that. Maybe there's no reason why I can't do that. So it's lots of it is imagination exercises and just challenging oneself to think, why not in all kinds of different ways.
So it's about like seeing how other people are able to do it and how they're not any different than you are. It's just your mindset holding you back, essentially.
You got it. Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That's it.
Great.
Yeah, one of the key sort of damaging effects of trauma is this sort of sense of disqualification, this sense of not enough. And when that gets cleared away, then it's like, wow, why not?
But if someone has gone through life for so long with that mindset, like how do they learn to, you know, adapt this new mindset? Like the first few months must be very difficult to have that complete shift. So, and those questions are always going to come back, like, oh, are you good enough? Like, how should they fight against these thoughts in the beginning so that they can train themselves to have these more positive mindsets?
It's at the mental level, it is a sense of sort of resetting again and again and again, replacing the old thoughts with the new thoughts. Indeed, that's part of it. The metaphor I like to use is I have this small dog, Bichon Frise puppy, and she's 3 years old and she's very, you know, energetic. So when we go for a walk, she's always tugging at the end of the leash. And so if I want a well-trained dog, then I have to tug her back and get her back walking the way I want her to walk. So that's a great metaphor for how we have to train our mind. Our mind is like an untrained puppy. It really is. And from time to time, we have to tug it back and get it back thinking the way we want it to be thinking. And it's just training our brain, just like you're training a puppy. Like, if you tug it back again and again and again, and of course, reward it now and again, then eventually the dog will, you know, walk the way you're asking it to walk. So definitely that's part of it. So it's the mental game. The other part of it is, you know, as I was saying before, trauma recovery particularly extends to anxiety recovery, but definitely trauma recovery particularly. It's actually as much changing what's below the neck as much as it is changing above the neck. So definitely we want to change our thoughts. But what we find is that if we change the emotions, if we resolve and settle the emotions so that fear is not dominating, our body and our emotions become much quieter. And when that happens, it's like magic. When that happens, then the new thoughts actually come automatically. And the old thoughts aren't pushing back in with the same force. So we want to train the mind like we're training a puppy. But also, if the trauma work is done well, then our body and our emotions have learned something different. Our body and our emotions have learned that it's safe. So it's safe to risk. It's safe to put your name in for that promotion. It's safe to maybe change careers in your 30s. I mean, which is probably pretty normal these days with the way the economy is. But, you know, the things that formerly were too scary, now, yeah, you know what? I can do that. And that's actually an emotion expressing itself when we say, I can do that. It's secondarily a thought, it's primarily an emotion.
Oh, interesting. So training your emotional body. Can you talk more about that? Like, how does one do that? Do you have any particular methods that you deploy?
Yeah. I'll describe one. I'm going to use myself just to keep it clear and for illustrative purposes. So you and I, we're chatting on this podcast, and, you know, mostly I'm having a really good time because I love talking about this stuff, and you seem like a really cool guy, and I love talking with cool guys. And, you know, in the back of my mind, there's a little bit of anxiety because, you know, I want to make sure that I'm clear. I want to make sure that I'm expressing myself well, and I'm wanting to, you know, I'm wanting this to be a good product for your audience. Okay. So I'm just, that's the truth in the back of my mind. So there's a little bit of anxiety, which is a little bit, you know, anxiety actually equals fear. So it's a little bit of a fear response going on. What if I don't make any sense here? And Wing goes, wow, Don, like that was stupid. You know, a little bit of that, what if something bad comes out of this? So that's my body and my nervous system slightly activated. Maybe 3.5 out of 10 on the activation scale. Okay. Not real strong, but it's there. So training the emotions and training the body might involve, this is one of the strategies, is I'm going to look around the room that I'm in, and you don't even notice that I'm doing it. I'm going to look around at a room that I'm in, and I'm going to notice that my puppy that I described before is no longer biting my hand. She's actually sleeping. This is a true story. She's actually sleeping beside me, and my hand is resting on her. And so when I notice that, when I turn my attention to that, there's nothing scary in the room that I'm in, and my puppy's sleeping beside me, and she's very calm, and she's very calming to me. Then when I put my attention on that, then that 3.5 out of 10, it actually lowers down. Because I'm shifting my attention to something calming. That calms my emotions, that calms my nervous system. And now, you can actually hear it in my voice, my nervous system activation has gone to mid. So what I've done is I've shifted my attention from the thing that is mildly scary. What if I mess up Wing's podcast? And I'm shifting my attention over to, oh, my puppy, Sophie, she's so cute and so calm and serene right now. She's making me calm and serene.
That's great. So beyond just calming, she's also like a loving figure in your life, right? So given how there's usually this polarity between fear and love, what do you see? Do you see that as an effective tool to kind of like reach out to things that sparks love in yourself to overcome.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, in my example, Sophia's calm and serene. So she helps me to be calm and serene. I could also just invoke in my mind, you know, in the middle of this conversation, again, you'd never know what I'm doing. Invoking in my mind, my partner that I know loves me and I love. And that's going to create feelings in my heart. Any memory from my past where I felt loved or I was extending love to somebody else. That, as I mentioned before, brain around our heart, brain around our gut. So if I'm thinking about my partner and how much she loves me, I'm actually creating a particular emotional state in this cluster of neurons in my heart. And that absolutely is going to reduce the level of fear.
Yes. Oh, Scott.
Yeah. So one of the exercises I ask people to do in therapy is create in their mind what's called a circle of love. And so it's imagining themselves surrounded by some people from their present or their past or even fictional people that are loving people. You know, so maybe their partner, maybe one of their children when their child was a baby, maybe a dog, maybe Mother Teresa. Doesn't matter. It doesn't even have to be somebody that they know personally, but just imagine being surrounded by a dog, a child, Mother Teresa, Gandhi, Dalai Lama. What would it feel like if you were surrounded by those people and they were looking on you with their love in their eyes? And it's amazing how calming and settling that is. Every person that I've done that exercise with, including myself, because I use it myself, they go, oh, yeah, you know what? I feel calm, but wait a minute, I feel a little bit more courageous too. I feel like I can take on a little bit more. I feel like I can take a risk a little bit more because I feel like these people have my back, and that's magic.
Cool. So essentially the way to do that would be to visualize them for a minute or so. How should we go about it?
Yeah. And this is an exercise that it is okay to try this at home, kids. no negative effects, no risk of overdose. It's pick the people that don't have a complicated relationship with you. Just three or four people is enough. And then imagine yourself being surrounded. So you're in the middle of a circle of those people. Just that. Feel what that feels like. Step two is, in your imagination, make eye contact with each of those people and feel what it feels like to see them looking at you with loving eyes. Very powerful. So each person in turn, so take a few seconds, 15 seconds to just focus in your imagination, eye contact with each person of the three or four people. And then one more time, go around again. And for each person, imagine what word of love they would say to you that is just the thing that that person would say to you to communicate their love, their support, maybe their nurturance. And just hear that word, hear that tone of their voice, and again, notice their eye contact for each person in the circle. And just the trick is that this is not just a cognitive exercise, this is like a felt experience exercise. And it is amazing how vitalizing that exercise is. It takes 15 minutes. I have it on my YouTube channel. This exercise has a YouTube video called Circle of Love. And it's just an amazing meditative exercise that people can do.
Cool. Yeah. I'll post that in the show notes. I've done like loving kindness meditations, which is kind of similar to that, and after doing each one of those, I do feel like how you mentioned. So revitalized and happier and more courageous for sure.
Courageous. Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to ask you more about your personal history of how you became who you are today and your journey towards your work and purpose. So you weren't always a counselor. This was something that you started 25 years ago, right?
Right. So I think some of your listeners will be encouraged to know I bummed around for my 20s. Didn't really know what I wanted to do with myself. So the starting place was I started in university studying mechanical engineering, which is probably the opposite, pretty much the opposite of what I'm doing now. And I did it. I mean, looking back, I realized much more clearly I did it because I thought it would please my parents. Yeah, if I had a nickel for everybody I've talked to that has gone down that road, I would have lots of nickels. So that didn't work out. I really didn't like it, and I really didn't do very well in it. And eventually the dean of the department said, Don, we really think that you should give mechanical engineering, you know, a break from you. So I left that and bummed around, did some different things. And basically I was looking for, you know, what am I supposed to be doing? What am I supposed to be doing with myself? What's for me? And the previous thing that I was doing was also quite distant from what I'm doing now. I was actually doing geological exploration. Good. So working like the wilderness, staking mineral claims and doing geological exploration, doing that for a couple of years. I mean, really, really fun work. But I knew that it was just not, it wasn't me, and it wasn't purposeful. Mm-hmm. The joke was that we're in the mining business, but actually we're mining investors' pocketbooks. It gives you an idea.
Yeah.
So I basically, the story is I witnessed the guy that I was living with was in a conflicted relationship with his girlfriend. And so him and his girlfriend were going and getting therapy. And I was like watching the process, and a little bit of a voyeur sort of hearing his debrief after the sessions of therapy. Long story short, they broke up and he was happier as a man after the therapy. And so I was watching that and I'm going, okay, so you go to therapy for your relationship, you lose the relationship, but you come out happier. I don't understand that, but I'm really, really intrigued by that. So that started me on a bit of a quest. I started some studies in the field. Frankly, I was too scared to really commit. This is what I want to do with my life. But the more I got into it, the more I realized this is what I want to get into. This is what I want to do with my life, because I want to make a difference in people's lives. That's the bottom line. I want to make a difference in people's lives. And as I was describing before, the way that I see making a difference that I'm particularly good at is, you know, getting into the heart of their life and finding out what's keeping them from living their best life and helping them get it, you know, get those obstacles out of the way. And I've found that, yeah, it really does make a difference in people's lives. It changes their relationships. It changes their life. It helps them be able to live to their full potential.
Yeah. Was there like an aha moment when you realized, yeah, this is my purpose? Like maybe a potential client, like a particular client that you work with? Or was this something you look back now, like, okay, this is my purpose?
I think it was, I mean, definitely it was an evolution. It was really an evolution of watching and noticing that I'm doing it. I think if there's an aha moment, actually, I can point to a couple of aha moments. One was, you know, as I say, sort of watching vicariously my roommate and his relationship, and that he's happier and more at peace with himself. That was one aha moment. The other aha moment was a friend of mine who had trained in counseling. She was in hospital. She had cancer, and I think at this point of the story, she knew that she was going to die from cancer. So she's in hospital, and so I go to visit her because I'm a friend, and that was part of the job, sort of unrelated, but it was part of the job that I was doing at the time was visiting visiting, you know, people in our sort of spiritual communities that are in hospital. So I go to visit her. And so I'm supposed to be this helpful, encouraging, uplifting guy, right? That's the way the script is supposed to go, right? I'm visiting her in the hospital and we got talking, and we're only talking for about 20 or 25 minutes. And dang it, she managed to turn the conversation around so that we're no longer talking about her and her terrible cancer diagnosis and the brutal chemo treatments that she's getting. And suddenly we're talking about me, and she's encouraging and uplifting me and instilling courage and risk-taking in me. And I left the conversation feeling way better about myself. And as I left and went back to my car, I'm going, pardon my language, shit. I want to be able to do what she did. In 20 minutes or half an hour, she turned the conversation and it became a very powerful and frankly impactful and life-changing conversation for me. I'm not sure how exactly she did that, but I want in on that. I want to do that because I want to change people's lives.
Wow. That's a great aha moment. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah. So before that interaction, you were having doubts about like, oh, do I really want to invest more years studying for this other topic when I spent so much time studying mechanical engineering for so long? Were you having some of those thoughts too blocking you?
I was having doubts. I was chicken. I mean, bottom line, I was chicken because it was to make that radical a shift was, you know, a shift of sort of vocational aspiration, and really it was a shift of it meant a shift of identity. It was a shift of identity from, you know, analytical math geek in mechanical engineering to, you know, these soft sciences in counseling. Like, oh my word, like that's a quantum shift. So it was both a shift, wow, that radical shift of vocation, radical shift of using different parts of myself. And, you know, of course, you know, the whole job security thing at that point in my life, I was newly married and I think I had a child on the way. So I'm worried about how am I going to support my family? So those things going on, and those are the things that sort of made me just afraid to commit and buy in. So I had to have a few other experiences of endorsement and sort of validation that I'm actually good at this. And those came along the way, and those were really, really pivotal and important also. And it was a slow, I think what's important and I think useful for our listeners is there's a slow process of me recognizing that I'm actually designed and wired to do this. Like this, as I mentioned before, this work just resonates really deeply with who I am. I'm a person that's naturally curious about people. I'm a person that I think naturally makes people feel comfortable, you know, in relationships. I'm not scary for people. And that's just like I don't have to try to do that. That's just kind of amazing.
So it sounds like you realize who you are, your true self, essentially, right?
Yeah, that's it. And found kind of found my true self and find myself in a vocation that just aligns really tightly with my true self. Mm-hmm. So, you know, over the course of a day doing sessions of therapy, it sort of feels like I'm not trying, like I'm not working because it's so natural and organic.
Yeah. So what kind of advice would you give for people who are trying to figure out the purpose? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing for sure is be conscious and aware of, you know, external voices, you know, like in my case, parent pleasing. Be mindful and cautious of having, you know, absorb those voices and you might be more obedient and compliant to those voices than is helpful for you. That's one thing for sure. And you might have to go against, you know, parental expectations, which can be very, very difficult for lots of people. The other piece of advice is just getting to know yourself really well and listening to the feedback that you get about yourself from other people. Like, who do people say you are? What is it that people say that you are natural at, that you're good at? And the hard thing, but the really important thing is to not immediately think about, oh, what job should I do? But just to sort of start to collect those attributes. You know, so for example, you know, I mentioned for myself, an attribute that I've learned that I have, because people have told me, is you're really easy to talk to. Oh, okay. Well, that's a piece of information. And I'm really curious about what makes people tick. There's another, it's just an attribute. And then collecting the attributes, put them all together, and then, okay, what's a vocation where I might deploy these attributes?
So let's say someone realized what their purpose is. But they are kind of in their comfort zone and they're too afraid to step towards that purpose. What steps should they take to get there?
Man up. That might not be the most constructive response here. What steps should they take? Gather together some cheerleaders, because these kinds of moves that we make in life are, you know, they're not for the faint of heart. We need support. We need encouragement. We need people on our side cheering for us. That's one thing for sure. Another thing that we need to make the shift is we need to set a plan in place. You know, what's the expression? A vision without a plan is a dream or something like that. So getting a plan into place, maybe it's a 5-year plan with some steps along the way. I think that can be really, really helpful. So, okay. So I'm not going to bail on this track and immediately go over here, you know, starting Monday morning, but I'm going to create a plan, a little bit of a flow chart for how I'm going to do that. At the end of the day, though, I'm actually reminded of a story. I wish I could remember the names. Maybe you can remember the names when you hear the story, Wing. But a story back in the early years of Apple computers, I guess it was Steve Jobs, needed a marketing guy for Apple computers, because Apple was like a really cool company, but really, really sucked at marketing. So they went to headhunt a marketing guy from Coca-Cola. I might be butchering the story, but this is how I remember it. And so hey, leave your secure job with the mega company Coca-Cola and come work for this like computer company in Silicon Valley that before Silicon Valley was even Silicon Valley. The line was, do you want to spend the rest of your life selling sugared water, or do you want to change the world?
Yeah.
How can you argue with that?
Yeah. That's a good story.
So the point is that, you know, if we're out of our, you know, our niche where we're just, you know, going to the motions, we're just doing the day job, it's going to show up on our own heart and soul. We're going to just kind of slowly start to feel the corrosive effects on our heart and soul. But larger than that, we're missing the opportunity to change the world, maybe not in an Apple computers kind of way, but change our quarter of the world. Because if we are in our niche and we are, you know, executing our meaning and our purpose in life, I absolutely believe that the resonance that happens means that we will change our corner of the world.
Wow, that's great. Thank you for those wise words. Wow, thank you.
Yeah.
And all right, so now I'd like to go to our lightning round. We're just going to ask you a bunch of short rapid fire questions. You can answer as short as you want.
Cool.
Ready? All right. What is one thing you like to do to relax?
I don't watch TV. So taking Sophie out for the walk is relaxing. That's the daily thing. Yeah.
Cool. What's one thing you like to do for fun?
Fun. I play with my partner. We have a beautiful, beautiful, silly, playful relationship, and we are silly together, which is not like, you know, this guy.
That's great. What is one thing that makes you enthusiastic?
How sick and twisted is it if I say trauma is what makes me enthusiastic? Seriously, learning new things and trying new things out, taking risks with YouTube videos, with podcasts, with Instagram Live, which I did this afternoon for the first time. Just trying new things turns me on.
Cool. And also trauma, helping people overcome trauma. That's not twisted, I would say. What is one habit you always do for a great day?
I use heart math as a form of meditation. Heart math it's a long story. We probably don't have time for it because this is lightning round, but basically it's a short meditation technique to elevate my mood and create brain heart coherence.
Cool. I'll look that up. What is one habit you are working on?
I want to get better at other forms of meditation throughout my day.
Mm-hmm. Great. What's the first thing that comes to mind? What's the most important lesson you've ever learned?
Most important lesson?
First that comes to mind.
The first one that comes to mind is the wisdom from 80-year-olds that we, at the end of our life, we don't regret the things that we did. We regret the things that we didn't do.
Yeah, great. What is a book that changed your life?
The Bible. Just as part of my midlife crisis in my late 20s, I got into the Bible and started to follow its teachings faithfully. And so really changed my worldview, changed my value system.
Interesting. Yeah. So before that, were you religious or you became more?
I was moral, but not religious. Yeah.
Cool. If you're not doing what you are doing today, what would you be doing instead?
Wow. You know what? I have no clue. The best answer I have is it would be something closely related, which is really kind of, you know, I would just move over one increment.
Okay. And what is your ideal life like?
Now or in the future?
Now or both, I guess. What comes up when I mention ideal life?
Ideal life is continuing to work at trauma treatment nomadically. And adding, still in a nomadic life, adding sort of other things to other digital products to my work, coaching, webinars, and things like that. Okay. I've been doing it nomadically.
So it sounds like you're living it now then.
I kind of am, yeah.
That's amazing. And how do you define purpose?
How do I define purpose? It's executing what I'm doing in my day aligned with intention, with my sort of larger value-informed intention.
Great. And lastly, do you have any requests you would like our listeners to do?
I would love for every listener to dare to imagine what their life would be like if they took that risk that they're afraid to take. And they know what I'm talking about.
That's great. Where can people find you?
Find me on my website, drdonrussell.com. Two S's and two L's in Russell. Also find me on Instagram, Dr. Don Russell, and find me on YouTube. Can't remember the address for that, but Google Dr. Don Russell or YouTube search Dr. Don Russell. You'll find me there.
Okay, great. I'll include all those links in the show notes. Wow, thank you so much, Dr. Don Russell, for being a part of a Work in Purpose podcast. This conversation was so, insightful. Thank you.
Hey, my pleasure. My pleasure. I'm so glad we got to do this. This is fantastic. My pleasure.
Great. I hope you've enjoyed this episode with Dr. Don Russell and that you come away with some useful tips on how to not just resolve your trauma, but to take it to the next level and to thrive with your purpose. Be sure to check out the links in the show notes for even more insights from Dr. Don Russell. So after a year of doing this podcast, I was reminded firsthand how our journey towards our purpose is never a straight line. Sometimes you take detours, sometimes you stay stuck, and sometimes you walk backwards. After the novelty of doing something new, like doing a podcast, starts wearing off, what happens then? Well, things like fear, laziness, procrastination, distractions, doubts, and negative self-talk. inevitably starts creeping in. And the louder they get, it can get easy to drift away from your journey towards your purpose, putting you back into your comfort zone. And that is why I think the start of a new year is such an important time for us to take a step back and do some self-reflection, to recalibrate, to remind yourself why you've chosen to go on the journey you've started, to remind yourself that things out of your control aren't out of your control. And that means the joy you get from working towards your purpose has to come from within, from the practice, and from being present. And for me, I was reminded how invaluable and how much joy it sparks in me to have these really deep, meaningful conversations with guests on my podcast on an always fascinating topic of purpose, which is something I normally don't get to do in my everyday life. And then being able to share their stories and insights out into the world to whoever is listening is just an incredible opportunity. I just feel so grateful for this new thing that I just started last year. So this has been a really great time to remind myself of all of that and to not bog myself down unnecessarily. So yeah, now I'm just super excited for what's to come in 2022. And thank you so much for tuning in to the second year of a Work in Purpose podcast. I encourage you to subscribe, to tell your friends about it, and to listen to the past episodes. So yeah, until next time, may your present moment now and forever be filled with light, love, and joy. This is Wing, and thank you for listening to A Work in Purpose.